A warning. This story touches on sensitive subjects like suicide and may not be suitable for all listeners. I'm Andy Richards, a journalist with the Birmingham Mail, and this is EG34B, the second episode in our series about the lonely death of Janet Parker. Of course, Birmingham has changed a huge amount in the last 40 years. Birmingham in 1978 was vastly different from the Birmingham of today. The city had the NEC. It had only been open for a couple of years, but there was little else to attract people to it. There was no Library of Birmingham, no Metro. And attitudes were vastly different in the 1970s too. I mean, racism was quite rife at the time. And this was the era too of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and the city in a sense was still reeling from the tragedy which happened 4 years earlier in the Birmingham pub bombings, when two city centre bars were bombed, 21 people dead, 200 injured. And when Janet Parker fell ill, it was effectively the largest medical crisis the city had faced since the pub bombings. Henry Bedson ran the regional smallpox lab, which was housed in the medical school in the east wing of the University of Birmingham. And there was an outer pox lab and an inner room called EG34B. And EG34B was the tiny room in which smallpox was handled. It was hardly bigger than a cupboard, and there were very few staff who had access to it, just the professor and two or three other members of staff. The professor was doing pretty vital work there on smallpox. Essentially, he was trying to second-guess what the virus may do as it was being eradicated. Was there any possibility that any residual virus could escape? Could it alter itself slightly and actually become something else? So the work that the professor was doing was pretty vital, but he had a problem. And the problem was that the lab was old. Effectively, it wasn't fit for purpose. And the lab was inspected by the World Health Organization. And the World Health Organization had concerns about some parts of it. So essentially, the professor said to them, well, look, if you'll just give me a few months more to complete my work, I'll be finished. And he was sure that the lab would be suitable for that length of time. And there was a letter exchange, a series of letters, between the professor and the World Health Organization. And effectively, ultimately, the World Health Organization said, well, yes, we do have concerns, but we know that the work that you're doing is very important. We're prepared to allow you to carry on until the end of the year. The professor was overjoyed. He actually received the news on the day that he returned from holiday. And he wrote back to the World Health Organization thanking them and telling them how much he was looking forward to meeting up with them at a conference in Geneva later in the year. I think that was the last time that he experienced elation and happiness, because a few hours later, that night, his phone rang at home. It was a colleague telling him that there had been a suspected smallpox case in the city, and worse still, they believed that it was connected with his lab.
Smallpox, that's what they say it is.
Smallpox? Surely not.
Well, it's not the sort of thing you expect in this country, is it?
Once the diagnosis of smallpox had been made, Janet was moved to Catherine de Barnes Isolation Hospital in Solihull. This was one of several hospitals in the UK, purpose-built for isolating infectious patients from the community at large. Mark Pollan again.
The issue also was not just to get Janet Parker out of that hospital, but there was a realisation that she wasn't just a patient, a person. She was a huge festering bioreactor of smallpox virus that could have infected anyone that had come into contact with her.
Dr. Deborah Simmons at East Birmingham Hospital started the work of contact tracing.
As Janet was being sent off, senior house officer Dr. Simmons was having to rack her brains to come up with who could have been contacts. Well, there was a man that came in to fix the bedpan washer. There was the ambulance men who had delivered patients, physiotherapists, a hospital chaplain. then she realised that what about those GPs that had seen her out in the community? Each of those had come into contact with her. She had a challenge. She had to do her day job of still looking after the patients, you know, care in the hospital, but she was also trying to help the outbreak investigation and management team.
And what we learned when we had outbreaks in the UK was that, generally speaking, when that happened, when there was an outbreak, usually quite a small one, handful of cases, often focused on a hospital, a few cases in the community, more people died of vaccination than died of the smallpox, because the vaccine itself is not that different from Jenner's vaccine, which is sort of 18th century vaccine, if you like. It is a different strain of virus. We don't really know where it came from. It's lost in the mist of time. If you tried to get vaccinia, the smallpox vaccine, licensed today, you would fail. It wouldn't pass because its side effects are too great. But on the other hand, would you rather have side effects from vaccinia with spots and a rash and all that, or die of smallpox? So the choice wasn't really a very difficult one.
Now, my first job is to try and prevent this from spreading. That's where you two can help. Now, I want from you, first of all, an exact account of her movements during the past week, the people she's seen and so on. Then I want to know whether you've sent any sheets or towels to the laundry, and if so, what laundry? And I want you both to go and get vaccinated first thing tomorrow morning.
I was done less than a year ago.
Sorry, I'm afraid you'll have to be done again. Now look, let's get down to these details, shall we?
Over the days that followed, the baton of responsibility was passed on to others. In particular, one individual, Surinder Singh Bakshi, was responsible for looking after the response to the outbreak in the city of Birmingham and out there in the community. He had been born in Africa and brought up in Africa, but he was part of a substantial expat Indian community in Africa, and he'd spent his life moving around various parts of what was then the British Empire and became part of the British Commonwealth. So he was brought up in what is now considered Tanzania, was at medical school in Uganda, had served as a medical officer in Zambia, and then had settled in the UK. And he'd only been in post in Birmingham for a year or two when suddenly this landed on his lap. And he had to very quickly put in place a series of arrangements so that he could deal with this. And when I interviewed him, he made it clear that he wanted all those nurses, community workers or whatever to feel safe. Many of them were working long hours, they were going home in the evenings. So he commandeered the local black taxi cab firm, set up a contract with them that would take all these people home at night. He said that he actually stocked up a fridge with some beer and drinks so that people, when they'd finished a long day of vaccinating people or going out and contact tracing, could actually relax a bit. He provided accommodation for people in a hotel in the centre of Birmingham. So very pragmatic decisions made, actually, how to run that. And that cascaded out through the community. Various people were tracked down on holiday and brought back from their holidays. There was one unfortunate physiotherapist contact of Janet Parker. Her name was Kathy Hyde. She was forced to cancel her wedding. There were supposed to be 100 guests coming to her wedding. Instead, she was forced to go into quarantine.
326 people were quarantined in their homes in Birmingham. Thousands more were vaccinated. Reg Wickett was working as an engineer at East Birmingham Hospital when Janet was brought in.
I was in charge of the building part. So whatever was the building, it was me. Painters, bricklayers, carpenters, anything like that. It was enjoyable to work there at that time, you know. But this one time, they told us we got to come out. And they said that they think they've got an infectious disease patient coming in. We think it might be smallpox.
The staff at the hospital were all vaccinated, and then Reg went away on a fishing trip. A couple of days into his holiday, the Bournemouth Health Authority tracked him down. He was given another vaccination and sent back to Birmingham. Reg had now had a double dose of the vaccine.
And his doctor came down with his needles, and he said, "You'll have to go back home again tomorrow." And he said, "Now, before you go, I'm going to have to inoculate everybody." So he gave me another one in this arm, and he gave me one in that arm to make sure. And then a couple of days later, I'm in bed and I just couldn't do a thing. Couldn't get up or nothing. And my wife at the time says, "You look green. You really look green, you know." And I thought, "Oh, I don't care, you know." That's how I was. And they sent for the doctor, and he came in a white coat with a mask on and a hat and gloves. And he says, "Catherine de Barnes, tomorrow morning, ambulance." And that was it. And they carried me downstairs in a chair to the front door, and there was a policeman standing outside telling everybody to keep away. And off we went. Then I was put into a cubicle on my own. I was having hallucinations. I was dreaming. I couldn't keep my eyes open. And they were pumping stuff into me, giving me tablets every 10 minutes, you know. And it was terrible for a couple of days. I didn't have my own mind. I was sort of dreaming. I just didn't know what was happening, you know. And every time I closed my eyes, I wanted to open them again quick. I was having nightmares and dreaming, and I think I woke up in the night as well, shouting. Either the professor or the nurse manager was there nearly all the time with me, you know. And then all of a sudden, I felt a lot better. And just like that, I said, "I shall have to have a bath," you know. The doctor come, Professor Morgan came, and he says, "Looks as if you might be able to go home in the weekend." And in no time, they fetched me wife, put me in the car, and I was back home. It all lasted about a week. That was my holiday, because I was back at work again on probably the Monday or the Tuesday morning.
John Richmond was the ambulance man who had brought Janet into East Birmingham.
We did the job. I washed my hands, as I do, and I couldn't afford a car in those days, but the wages wasn't very good. And I used to have to walk from Bristol Road Depot up to the Sally Oak Station, up the hill. Get on the train, get off at Longbridge, and then I got about a mile walk then to get the top of Edenhurst Road where I was living. Whatever job I fit, whatever shift I was on, I always stripped off and had a shower. I changed my knickers and socks and shirt, but I couldn't change my uniform. You know, and I got one uniform.
John still didn't know that Janet Parker, the patient he had taken in, had contracted smallpox. He took the train into work the next day.
Walked down to Bristol Road Ambulance Depot, and I could sense something wasn't right. And the chap in the office came out to me then, and he said, "You've caused some trouble." I said, "Me?" I said, "What have I done?" He said, "The blokes won't turn out." I said, "What do you mean they won't?" He said, "They won't go out on treble nines or anything." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because of you." I said, "What do you mean because of me?" He said, "That job you did yesterday." I said, "What job?" He said, "That woman you took in the last job." I said, what was the matter with Janet Parker?" I said, "What was the matter with her?" He said, "She's got smallpox." And I won't tell you the language, but the lad said, they said, "Get a doctor down here quick, let's have a jab." So the doctor came down, gave us all a jab. Guess where I was in the queue? Guess where I was, the bloke that had done the job? I was at the back of the queue. The officers that sit in the office was at the front of the queue, all worried about the cell. Anyway, we did that, and they said, "Right, you've got to take this ambulance," as it was, to Catherine de Barnes. There was a man stood at the gate there looking over, and he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "We've come to bring the ambulance to be stoked out." He was Professor Morgan. I always remember his name. Well, he said, "How have you come to work?" He said, "How have you come in?" I said, "On the train." Oh, he went mad. Professor Morgan went mad. He said, "Well, didn't anybody tell you?" I said, "Well, nobody phoned me up when I got home on the night, which they could have done. Nobody mentioned it till I got to work next morning, and nobody's all blaming me." When I eventually got my payslip, I noticed there was an addition on it, and it had got AD ADAC allowance, and it was for 63 pence for smallpox for carrying the patient for an hour, for nursing her for an hour on the ambulance. That's what I got it for. Nobody ever knew smallpox on your wage slip before. Do you know, you'll never see that again.
Malcolm Tomlinson was a colleague of John Richmond's in the ambulance service.
Inoculations for smallpox were mandatory for many years, and then I became voluntary. And that particular year, myself and my crewmate Jim, we decided that we would have the smallpox vaccination. We went into work on the morning, and it was bedlam, to be quite honest, because the news had broken about the smallpox case. The fact that John and George, who carried the lady, were on the station at the time, and they all refused to go out because they wanted inoculations, but we were immune, so we went out.
Malcolm took Janet's bedclothes to Catherine de Barnes' isolation hospital.
The procedure with infectious cases was that there was a special bin at the back of the station where you put infectious laundry, and it was treated differently. And a few days later, the blankets that Janet Parker were wrapped in were discovered at the back of the station, and the boss wanted a volunteer to take them over to Catherine de Barnes. And when I turned round, all my mates had disappeared and I was left standing there. But I've never really been bothered about infectious things. I think it's things that you don't know about that are the problem. If you know about things, then you can take precautions. And this then involved me going over to the Heartlands and having another inoculation and picking up some old clothes, going back to the station, dressing up in these old clothes, and for your information, the flies on the trousers didn't work, and I think my mates sabotaged them. When we got there, I got out of the vehicle, and the vehicle was taken into the yard for disinfecting and all the linen to be destroyed. I went into a cleansing station. You strip off, go into another room, have a shower, and then go into another room where your clean clothes are waiting for you. But unbeknown to me, that disinfected my glasses. My glasses were thick black horn-rimmed glasses, similar to Eric Morecambe, and the disinfectant turned them matte white, and I looked like Timmy Mallett when they'd finished. Well, the service didn't buy me any new ones. I wore them till I could afford some new ones. I've got a good memory of a lot of things that took place in my career. I think that stands out because of what happened in the mess room at work, which was totally unusual and out of character, and also the trauma that John and George went through. And I think the thought of what could have happened, because John had come to work on public transport, and to my knowledge he still had the clothes on that he carried it with. Potentially it could have been quite a bad outbreak.
Julie Brown was 14 in 1978 and remembers that summer well.
At the time, I was a girl guide and quite excited to think that I was going on a week's camp to Crickheath in Wales, and it was all very exciting. But my parents had said, "We will pay, but you've got to sort your own spending money out." So a previous interest I'd had was ice skating, and I had some ice skating boots. And I said, "Could I sell these?" So I did. I put an advertisement in Birmingham Evening Mail. And on the Sunday lunchtime, we had a phone call. And a lady turned up and said, "I've come to buy these ice skates on behalf of my niece, who has just decided that ice skating is her interest." And as far as I was concerned, "Yes, please, thank you very much." And she gave us the £3 notes for these ice boots, and off she went. My dad goes out for a lunchtime pint, and when he come home, I've sold my skates. So there we are, sold these ice skates, and as far as I was concerned, that was the end of it. 2 weeks later, I went off on my camp with my £3 spending money. On the Sunday lunchtime, a police car and another car pulled onto the campsite. It really was only a field, so it was a bit exciting. "Oh, we've got a police car." And I was called to the main tent on the camp and said, "I'm afraid, Julie, you're going to have to go home." "Why?" "The lady who came and bought your ice skates, that lady is called Janet Parker, and she has contracted smallpox. Her job is at Birmingham University, and I'm afraid, because you were in contact with her, this gentleman here is going to take you home."
Julie and her mother had to go into quarantine at home. Doctors had shown some concern over an insect bite on Julie's leg. Her dad, who wasn't there when Janet had called, had to move out of their house for a few weeks.
Quite a big flash car arrived outside and they tapped the door and they dressed in like white paper suits and white masks, and then both Mum and I were vaccinated. And the week continued. My father came to the kitchen window and waved hello and gave us a bag of shopping and that sort of thing. Each day, around the same time, during the morning, someone would come, strip us, see that we hadn't got any marks, anything that was altering how we felt, or but this little bite on my leg was then disappearing. So that was a good sign. When the consultants from the medical team came and seen us, they said, I understand that you were paid, yes, £3 notes. Well, they took those from us as well, which they tell us had to be destroyed. They did replace them. They did give me £3 back.
Paul Hooper was a newly qualified environmental health officer in Birmingham in 1978. He remembers his colleague who also missed out that summer.
One of the officers involved in the case was actually John Hammond, the person who went to Janet Parker's property, and he was a senior officer, and he was actually quarantined along with many other people. And unfortunately for him, he missed out on quite a significant opportunity from his leisure side of things. It was a big visit that he was going to be engaged in. I'm not quite sure exactly where it was, but I'm sure it was a Royal Palace visit, and he was very closely associated with the Musical Box Society. In his spare time, he used to repair musical boxes with the little pins and things, and he was quite excited about going to visit this. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, which he didn't get. Yeah, it's great. I mean, he organised the whole thing and then couldn't go because he was in quarantine. At the time, I being relatively young, I suppose I thought this was the sort of thing that happened all the while. And I didn't, only now with the benefit of hindsight did we realise how out of the ordinary it was, how different, how actually quite hazardous it could have been. And in many respects, we were joking about him being in quarantine and what sort of food we could deliver. So obviously anything that was flat, burgers, pizzas, could go through the letterbox. But it was... We made light of it at the time, but looking back, it was quite a serious event.
Lab boss Professor Henry Bedson was also in quarantine. Owen Wade, the new dean of the medical school at the University of Birmingham, came to visit him on the evening of August 30th. Henry looked tired and told him that he thought he would be crucified because of what had happened. He seemed to cheer up when they discussed his work on smallpox and Henry's involvement with the WHO eradication campaign, which had taken him to Pakistan and Ethiopia. When Owen Wade left Henry's house that night, he had no idea he would be the last person, apart from his family, to speak to Henry. The press gathered outside his home in Harborne for several days. Ian Mean was news editor of the Birmingham Mail at the time.
Birmingham Mail was a big, big operation. The largest regional evening newspaper at that time, selling at its height something like 365,000 copies a day. I was chief news editor. There was something like 10 people on the news desk, and I had nearly 60 reporters. There were great, great people there. Lots and lots of reporters who went on to national newspapers. Philip Lim, the medical correspondent, a nutcase, complete nut. But he was fastidious about his contacts, whether they be surgeons in his specific sphere of medical journalism, or police or firemen, whatever. He was absolutely brilliant at contact making. He was tenacious. Absolutely tenacious. He had some weird ways of getting stories, but he always got it. He was an old-fashioned reporter who drank too much, a lot of the time during the day, unfortunately. He would sometimes go out to the pub at lunchtime, leave his coat on the back of his chair, and I'd say, "Where's Phil Lim?" One of the girls would say, he's just gone out. I said, "Ring the pub." He'd run back, hair soaking wet. He'd obviously been out to the pub. The phone call came, rang back, started typing away. Amazing character, They don't make that sort of guy anymore, unfortunately.
It was Phil Lim who was sent to Professor Bedson's house in Harborne.
We needed to be there first. Birmingham needed to be there first. You know, this was a major story. The Times particularly were very active on this, as were international newspapers and other media. I wanted us to be first with the interview with Professor Bedson. There were lots of issues over this. It was claimed we were harassing him. I didn't accept it. I never accepted it. And I asked Philip to keep going, despite that criticism. Reporters 30-odd years ago were often criticised for being too heavy with people when they interviewed them. I think the fact that was because there was a lot of competition in those days. You know, there was no internet then. We had newspapers, radio and television. You know, when you went on a story in Birmingham, remember all the nationals had reporters here. Some, like the Mirror, would have three reporters here. So they were mob-handed. And we needed to be tough with people. But I always tried to be fair. And the very best reporters, they listen. They get the story out of the people by gaining their confidence and listening to them. I think that it is still the case that on the smallpox story, the Mail would have pursued exactly the same tack that I did with Philip Lim all those years ago. And that was, we needed to get to the heart of the story. The heart of the story was Professor Bedson.
Henry Bedson knew only too well that he was the heart of the story. Effectively under house arrest, Henry and his wife Pat were plagued with phone calls from the press. The conscientious Bedson insisted on answering many of them, afraid his silence would indicate some kind of cover-up. On the 1st of September, under quarantine in their family home, Pat found her husband locked in the garden shed. He was unconscious, but still alive. With reporters tying up the phone line, Henry's wife had to call 999 several times before getting through to an ambulance. Henry was taken to hospital, but died a few days later. He was 48. Here's Hugh Pennington again.
I'm not a psychiatrist, but it was a sort of statement. It was a sort of, I'm going out, and I'm not going out in a pleasant, easy sort of way. And, you know, basically, it's the end of a very sad story, and I'm taking responsibility for it. You could read that into it.
At the inquest into Bedson's death a couple of days later, Coroner Richard Whittington accused the press of harassment. He read out the professor's suicide note.
I'm sorry to have misplaced the trust which so many of my friends and colleagues have placed in me and my work, and above all to have dragged into disrepute my wife and beloved children. I realise this act is the least sensible thing I have done, but it may allow them to get some peace.
The coroner's comments prompted the press council to launch an inquiry. It found that there had been no evidence of harassment by the press. The report suggested that the university or local health authority should have fielded the telephone inquiries from the press, stating,
"In the council's view, there is something wrong with the system when someone as vulnerable as Professor Bedson is subjected to such heavy pressure from public, press, television and radio inquiries, on top of the strain and concern and extra work which the smallpox infection must have caused him."
Dr. Jugit Sangera was a former student of Professor Bedson.
I just felt that he was pressurised from the media, which is, I suppose the media's got to do their job. They don't know the ins and outs of it. But I think my impression of that was the fact that he was made a bit of a scapegoat, really. There was a lot of sympathy. The fact that if you knew him and his personality and his character and his talents, because the NHS is really for the patients, not really. There's no selfish needs here. You know, especially people working in medical schools and research, there's no personal gain at all. really financial gain, I think, at all. So, and he was one of those old doctors, you know, with the tradition of doing something for the worldwide. Because it's a worldwide project. I think we're probably the only, there's only two or a couple of the centres who did that. I think we're probably the other one. And then you are looking at 40-odd years ago, things have moved on and we've learned a lot of things. So at that time, maybe retrospectively we can say a lot of things, but at that time I think one could not be blamed. I felt sorry for the family, the kids, and the loss to the medical school with his experience and to the world, you know, the world medical people in his field. But I feel that the media that week went really high pressured on him. And one, because it was rare, the scare around, and he just took it as a personal thing, which I think was sad.
I would have to say that I'm not surprised at what he did, in the sense that he had a strong conscience. I'd never heard that he had any kind of depressive illnesses or anything like that, which is a sort of risk factor for what he did. But on the other hand, the circumstances were so frightful. He was involved in the last case of smallpox in the world, and it would be associated with his name forever. And he had the family tradition as well. You know, his father had been knighted for his microbiological work, and all that had come to nothing. So I'm not surprised at what Henry did, I'm afraid. There was the paper trail of the advice that the lab wasn't really 100% fit for purpose, and all that just combined to make this a really fantastically sad tragedy.